Welcome to AJP Audio for April 2022. I'm Aaron Van Dorn. Today on the podcast, I spoke with Dr. Brian Kelly, professor of sociology at Purdue University in West Lafayette, Indiana, about a recent paper he co-authored published in the American Journal of Psychiatry, looking at county-level data on opioid prescribing rates and its impact on misuse of opioids. Afterwards, AJP Editor-in-Chief Dr. Ned Kalin will join us to put the April issue into context. Dr. Kelly, your paper looked at county-level opioid dispensing rates across the United States to see if changes in dispensing rates affected opioid misuse, both of licit and illicit opioids. What did you find?
Well, the key take-home points are that county-level opioid dispensing rates are directly associated with prescription opioid misuse, the frequency of misuse, and drug dependence on prescription opioids at the individual level. Changes in dispensing were not associated with shifts in heroin use within the population. This essentially means that reductions in opioid dispensing over the course of the past decade have contributed to reducing prescription opioid misuse, but these reductions don't appear to have adversely affected heroin use within the population, which has been a concern with respect to the issue of tapering opioid dispensing in the population.
Why did you want to look at county-level data as opposed to state or national data? Did you find significant variation between counties?
Yeah, that's a really great question. The United States doesn't have a singular unified prescription opioid problem that's played itself out in the same way in every state. There's a tremendous amount of between state variation with respect to patterns of misuse and outcomes like overdose mortality. And this is also the case for counties within states. So for example, in my home state of New York, there are relatively high rates of opioid dispensing in the western counties of the state, and relatively low dispensing in the counties of Queens and Brooklyn in New York City, several hundred miles away. And we wouldn't necessarily expect one to have an impact on the other hundreds of miles away, right? So given that people who misuse prescription drugs are often utilizing their own medications, or they're obtaining medications from friends and family, you'd expect that you're going to better capture the effect of prescription opioid dispensing locally, especially in geographically large states.
What accounts for the level of variation in opioid dispensing between counties? Is it a question of policy, or is it as simple as individual clinicians making dispensing decisions that have a localized effect?
The answer to that question is it's complex, which I know is not a terribly satisfying answer, but it can't really be reduced to just a single thing. So it's going to have a wide variety of sort of structural bases in terms of why that's happening, more so than it's just about how clinicians are necessarily making decisions at the individual level of the clinical encounter. So it could be structuring in terms of why it is that certain conditions with pain are popping up for within certain regions as opposed to others, right? Are certain areas just getting to people treatment earlier in the process so that pain management becomes less of a need later on? It's going to have to do with things like the age gradient of the population within a local county, right? You have some counties that have young, vibrant populations, and you'd expect that there's going to be less opioid prescription dispensing happening in counties with younger populations. Mm-hmm. And then also things like the geographic distribution of access to care more generally, right? We might expect that within rural counties, for example, there are probably fewer opportunities for alternative pain management therapies. You know, things like physical therapy, for example, are harder to get to in rural regions than they are when people are living in cities. And that's double the case when people are experiencing pain in terms of travel related to physical therapy. And so, again, those are just three things that I think help contribute towards this, but it is a complex problem that is multifactorial in nature.
You found that contrary to a lot of concerns coming out of the opioid epidemic, decreased rates of opioid prescriptions did not lead to an increase in heroin use. Were you surprised by that finding?
I'm not sure that I'd say we were surprised, but I think it illustrates an important point, and that's namely that the growth in heroin use within the United States over the course of the last 20 years can't simply be reduced to opioid prescribing and dispensing within the healthcare system as a singular influence. I think, back to what I was just saying, I think the real story is much more complicated. I mean, while there are certainly individuals who have transitioned to heroin use after experiencing dependence on prescription opioids, on a population level, this is realistically a problem that has its foundation in multiple factors. And this is definitely an area in which I think more research is needed.
If increased rates of opioid dispensing leads to increased opioid misuse, it raises the question, how do we strike the right balance between minimizing misuse while ensuring the needs of people in need of pain management?
That is the million-dollar question, Aaron. I think it's fair to say that there are a number of policy decisions, such as the introduction of prescription drug monitoring programs or pain management clinic laws that have certainly helped. Yet I think that finding the right balance is going to remain a challenge and one that needs to be monitored and tweaked over time as new medical technologies emerge and other treatment options evolve over time. But at the end of the day, one of the things that this comes back to routinely is that pain is still a symptom that is largely dependent upon patient self-report rather than some sort of objective physiological measure. And so, you know, I wish I could sit here and tell you that I have all the answers on this, but I think realistically, we're still figuring out. And I think that we should expect that, you know, prescribing guidelines are going to continue to evolve as we work towards finding the right balance. And I think that this is, you know, probably going to be a key focal issue for the next 10 years in terms of figuring out how we can find that right balance within the U.S. Certainly other countries have found a much better balance than we have. And so I think I'm hopeful that we'll get there.
What are the clinical implications of your research? What should happen with opioid dispensing practices in light of your findings?
I think that although problems specific to prescription opioid misuse have receded to some degree, I think it's important for clinicians to remain mindful that the dispensing of opioids does have a clear effect on prescription drug misuse and on prescription drug dependence. And this extends beyond just patient populations, because I think it's important to bear in mind that once the patient has the prescription, it's largely out of the clinician's control in terms of what ultimately happens to that prescription. I think the key thing is we certainly don't want to become overconfident and that we've moved beyond a problem with prescription drug misuse. I say prescription drug misuse rather than specifically prescription opioid misuse, because I still think that there's some room for improvement with respect to other controlled substances, whether they be benzodiazepines or prescription stimulants, in terms of monitoring their dispensing, because they are also certainly having effects in some ways. At the same time, I think that clinicians can feel comfortable to some degree, given that the reductions in opioid dispensing that we've witnessed over the past 10 years have had some sort of measurable effect. And yet this hasn't necessarily adversely influenced heroin use on a population level.
Can you tell us about the other half of your data set, the National Survey on Drug Use and Health from the Centers of Disease Control and Prevention?
The National Survey on Drug Use and Health has really been a hugely important epidemiological surveillance system for the United States for about 50 years. It's been our most consistent source of data on patterns of substance use within the U.S. It's essentially a large-scale household survey, and presently they survey approximately 65,000 Americans ages 12 and older every year. It's a repeated cross-section survey, so they're not following individuals over time. And this is really important in terms of giving us snapshots of patterns of substance use across the population over time. The data set are very widely used by scholars who are doing research on substance use. It's actually the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration within the Department of Health and Human Services that is essentially the steward of this National Survey on Drug Use and Health data. Yeah, the data have been very important for people studying patterns of substance use over time.
What are the next steps for your research?
Well, my co-author, Mike Volo, and I do a fair amount of work related to substance use policies as well. And so one thing that might be of interest to the listeners of this podcast is actually a forthcoming paper that focuses on prescription drug monitoring programs and the mechanisms by which they've affected overdose mortality. We essentially are looking at the specific process of how prescription drug monitoring programs influence patterns of mortality potentially. And we examine the effect of a generalized system of surveillance is sufficient to produce changes that manifest in reductions in overdose mortality, or whether prescribers and clinicians must be mandated to act by checking the prescription drug monitoring system. And we actually found that the general system of surveillance is actually what moved the needle on overdose mortality. And the addition of laws that mandate clinicians and pharmacists to check the system don't provide an additional benefit.
Dr. Kaley, thank you for speaking with us today.
Happy to do so, Aaron.
Next up, Dr. Ned Kalin on the April issue. Hello, Dr. Kalin. Welcome back to AJP Audio.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Earlier in this episode, I spoke with Dr. Brian Kaley about opioid prescribing rates and their impact on opioid misuse patterns. How does this fit in with the rest of the April issue of AJP?
So the April issue of AJP is a very interesting issue. We have both clinical papers and papers that are more basic from the standpoint of some of the science that we're highlighting that's important to the field. And the paper on prescribing patterns in relation to opiate use is a very interesting paper and is a part of a set of papers actually that address issues related to opiates that are very clinically relevant. The opiate use paper that you're alluding to is a study that very carefully looks at using demographic data, opiate use and misuse and dependence in relation to prescribing patterns. This, what's interesting about this particular study, which I'm sure was discussed, is that this is done at the county level so that it gets very local data. And the basic finding is that increased numbers of prescriptions related to opiates is definitely related to increased misuse of opiates in individuals that have been prescribed medications. Another interesting point from this study is that while this relationship existed, it did not affect the use of illicit drugs. So that is to say that when there were changes in the prescription rates for opiates, sometimes there's been concerns that reductions in opiate prescriptions would drive individuals to take other drugs that would help them control their pain or would be related to the mechanism of action of the opiates. And in this case, the investigators looked at heroin usage and did not find that that was increased in this population.
The other paper looking at opioid use disorder is by Watts et al. What can you tell us about that?
So that paper also is highly relevant. In this particular paper, the investigators looked at a large VA database of patients that had received medication treatment for opioid use disorder and asked the question whether or not ongoing treatment for opioid use disorder was associated with a decrease in deaths related to suicide, accidents or injury, as well as total cause mortality or deaths. And importantly, what the investigators found from this very large sample was that the effective, or the treatment of opioid use disorder, when patients were in treatment, their likelihood or their hazard ratio for committing suicide was markedly decreased, as was all-cause mortality. And this was when compared to when individuals were stably off treatment. So, you know, in this large cohort of individuals that had opiate use disorder and were treated in the VA system, when during treatment, the risk decreased compared to the risk off treatment. And so this is, you know, important data supporting obviously the importance of effective interventions for opioid use disorder, but also the importance in relation to reducing other risk, in this case, suicides. What's interesting about this also is that the investigators examined whether or not different medication treatments had different outcomes. And what they found was is that the reduction in risk for suicide was mostly attributable to treatment with buprenorphine, whereas the other treatments, methadone and naltrexone, were suggestive of this type of effect, but were not statistically significant. So taken together, these two papers highlight clinically relevant issues from the standpoint of being mindful of using opiates as prescription drugs and being mindful of how they're prescribed and understanding that rates of prescriptions in general and amounts of drug available are definitely linked to more use and misuse of the drugs. And importantly, when individuals are treated for opioid use disorder during treatment that is continuous, there is a significant reduction in the risk to commit suicide or to die from all-cause mortality in the study that we had the opportunity to present in the journal.
Beyond the papers on opioids, we have two that are looking at schizophrenia. What can you tell us about them?
The schizophrenia papers are also quite interesting, and these papers are targeted at two different levels of investigation. And again, I think this is one of the things that's particularly exciting about this issue of the journal, bringing together basic translational science research with clinical work and clinical research. And these papers on schizophrenia really exemplify that the importance of both of these approaches. The clinical paper is a paper that looks at the associations between how long it takes for a person with a psychotic disorder to get their initial treatment in relation to the onset of their first symptoms. And that's called the duration of untreated psychosis. And the question is how does that duration, that period between symptoms and actual treatment, how does that interval relate to long-term outcomes? It suggested with various data sets and supported by various data sets over the years that the longer it takes for an individual to get treatment who suffers from schizophrenia, the poorer the outcome of that individual. And so there's lots of data for that. It's unclear exactly why that is the case. There's been a lot of ideas put forward and evidence to support those ideas, including the idea that people that have a longer duration to treatment basically have a more severe illness, perhaps, or the idea that there's a toxic process that's going on in the brain that is occurring during this period of untreated illness that has long-term impacts. And there's also been a suggestion that this effect is really an artifact of the way that people have been looking at it from a statistical standpoint. And actually, we had a recent article in AJP considering that. This particular paper is really a nice piece because it has the opportunity to present data for a cohort of patients over a 20-year follow-up period, and such that roughly 171 patients started and were assessed at about 5 or 6 intervals over the next 20 years to really much more accurately determine their longitudinal course of symptoms and illness. And these investigators asked, how does that longitudinal course and their outcome relate to the initial duration of untreated psychosis prior to or during their first psychotic episode for these patients? So very rich, well, deeply studied longitudinal data set. And the bottom line is that the researchers found that, again, the longer the duration of untreated psychosis, the poorer outcome, and that this was even seen all the way out to 20 years, which is remarkable. Basically, what they found was that both positive and negative symptoms, as well as symptoms related to functional capacity and quality of life, were related to the duration of untreated psychosis. So this really speaks to the importance of not only early diagnosis, but more rapid and effective treatments early on, because it suggests that the possibility that more rapid treatments, less time with untreated psychotic symptoms early in life, or during the onset of the illness, or the expression of the illness, may be linked to better outcomes. So it's a really nice piece and further supports all of these issues. A really nice editorial by Dr. Ashok Malla from McGill University also talks more about the efficacy of early intervention services and how to think about the current data in relation to new treatments. The other paper is a more basic science-related paper and introduces our readership to concepts that are important from the standpoint of circuits that are related to schizophrenia, but also what we call the microcircuits, which are the different ways that different cell types or neurons are wired and interact with each other to result in neurophysiological processes and alterations that we know to be associated with schizophrenia. This also dovetails with an overview that we have in the journal written by Dr. Vikas Sohal, who in much more depth gets into why it's important to understand different cell types in the brain, especially in the prefrontal cortex, and how these cell types interact with each other in ways that build circuits, and then how those circuits are related to cognition and behavioral modification and modulation, as well as emotion modulation. So this particular paper by the original research paper that is co-authored by Chung et al., this research group looked at postmortem tissue from brains collected from schizophrenic individuals and also control individuals. And what they looked at was they looked at a particular region of the brain called the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, which is a critical part of the brain and the prefrontal cortex that is unique to primates and humans and really serves to regulate higher order executive functions and cognitive functions. This particular part of the brain is known to be altered in its function in relation to schizophrenia, and also has been linked to the cognitive alterations and deficits that occur in schizophrenic subjects and other individuals that have cognitive alterations that are associated with different types of psychopathology. There's a particular electrical signature that's associated with this part of the brain and also with working memory and executive functions. This is called gamma band electrical activity. It's high frequency electrical activity. And it's believed that this electrical activity that is an organizing influence, bringing together different brain regions to function together, as well as an influence from the standpoint of actually modulating other circuits and even affecting perhaps things like neuroplasticity. So in schizophrenic subjects, both working memory, cognition, and this gamma band electrical activity are altered and are reduced. And it's thought that the cognitive functions that are part and parcel of what we see in schizophrenic patients is in part related to the alterations in this gamma oscillatory power or gamma electrical activity. So that's a long prelude to what these investigators looked at and found. These investigators wanted to try to understand if they could get a better handle on the cell types and molecules that underpin these alterations. And so by looking at the brains of schizophrenic patients and comparing them to controls and looking at the circuitry in the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, the investigators found that the microcircuit that has to do with, we believe, gamma oscillations seems to be altered. And what's altered is a very specific cell type interaction. One of the components of the microcircuits, which is described in the paper by Dr. Sohol in the overview, is the input from excitatory neurons onto inhibitory interneurons. And in this case, what are considered as subtype of interneurons or the parvalbumin interneurons. And it's thought that that connectivity between those two cell types is a critical component of the microcircuit in the prefrontal cortex that is related to gamma oscillations. And again, gamma oscillations, we believe, are related to higher order executive and cognitive functions and actually may even mediate some of those. What these investigators found was that there was much more variability and the amount of excitatory input onto these particular interneurons, these DLPFC parvalbumin interneurons, and that that increase in variability, the amount of input to these neurons, actually could account for the alterations in the gamma rhythms and the alterations and the subsequent alterations in cognition and symptoms, perhaps, in some schizophrenic subjects or participants. And the way that they found this out was that they took this data that they derived from postmortem brains and then used a computational model to further investigate the possibility or the potential of these alterations from the standpoint of increased variability in the excitatory input to these neurons as actually having a causal link to the alterations in gamma. So it's complicated from the standpoint of brain electrical activity, circuits, cells, and even microcircuits, but it highlights why it's important to understand the brain at this level, as this paper really gives us insights into the very basic mechanisms in brain organization and cellular organization that may be related to a circuit alteration that's critical in symptom formation and disability in schizophrenic subjects. So I think what's really exciting about this issue overall for me is the side-by-side presentation of very clinically relevant papers. For sure, the two papers on opiate use. Again, just to summarize, the papers on opiate use demonstrate the importance of being mindful of prescription management in patients with pain and who have other needs for opiates, as well as the reduction in suicide in individuals who are particularly being treated with buprenorphine for opiate use disorder. The paper on schizophrenia really highlighting the importance clinically of early interventions and reducing this duration of untreated psychosis time as a potential modifiable factor to have a long-term impact on a more positive outcome for schizophrenic individuals. And then finally, two papers, the original research paper and the overview, delving into the mechanistic underpinnings at a cellular, neuronal, and microcircuit level in the prefrontal cortex that are important to understand if we are going to understand the pathophysiology that underlies, in this case, schizophrenia and other psychiatric illnesses, and also use this information to inform new treatment strategies that would be targeted at some of these molecular alterations.
Dr. Kalin, thank you once again for your insights.
You're very welcome. It's a pleasure.
Join the APA Foundation in crucial conversations around mental health where you live, learn, work, worship, and play by listening to our podcast, Mentally Healthy Nation. You can find archived as well as our latest episodes on decriminalizing mental illness and zero tolerance policies by visiting mentallyhealthynation.org. We hope to see you there.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the individual speakers only and do not necessarily represent those of the American Psychiatric Association. The content of this podcast is provided for general information purposes only and does not offer medical or any other type of professional advice. If you're having a medical emergency, please contact your local emergency response number.